Well, this afternoon I want to share with you, as we continue in this subject of biblical principles for leadership, the issue of leadership, its perils. The title of this I gained from a book that J. Oswald Sanders published in 1967. It's a tremendous book on leadership. It's called Spiritual Leadership. Many of you will have read it, I'm sure. And I was just browsing through it a little while ago, and I noticed that he had a chapter. It was chapter 19 that he'd entitled The Peculiar Perils of Leadership. And I thought that was good. Now, as I say, a great book, tremendous insight, and very helpful and very challenging. His subheadings in relation to the perils of leadership were these: pride, egotism, jealousy, popularity, infallibility, indispensability, elation and depression, which we'd call manic depression. That was the list of the perils of spiritual leadership. You know, folks, times change, and emphases change, and trends change. And if we were to consider some of the perils of Christian leadership today, I wonder where we would go. I wonder what sort of a list we would draw up. And as I talk about change just there, recognize that the society in which we live changes at a rapid rate. And if we as church leaders do not identify that and make adjustments within our local churches to cope with it, we're going to get behind. We're going to be out of touch and not have an impact in the community. Keep that in mind. Here are some changes that you may be interested in. Talking about times that are changing. Here are the changes that have taken place within the realms of schools. From the 1940, here are the top concerns in 1940 of problems in schools. These were identified in the US, but they have certainly a strong parallel with us here. Number one problem was talking in class. Number two was chewing gum. Number three was making noise. Four was running in school. And this one, getting out of line, was just unacceptable. The wearing of improper clothing was frowned upon, and the same was not putting paper in the wastebasket. They were the real issues that they had to struggle with back in the 1940s. How many of you were in school in the 1940s? There were a few. How about that? Memory. The 1980s, we've just moved out of the 1980s. Here are the concerns. Drug abuse, alcohol abuse, pregnancy, suicide, rape, robbery, and assault. They're the problems today. Times are a change, as somebody once said. We need to realise that this is the case, and that we as Christian leaders, or potential leaders, have to recognise that the times are changing for us. If they're changing like that within the school system, they've got to be changing for us in life and living. What would be the top 10 problems we'd list? You've got a few blanks on your pages there on page 8. Let me fill you in with some of those. Problems in leadership, and these are real ones, where those little arrows are pointing. If you put stress on the first one, you'd be pretty right. Stress is very real in the experience of Christian leaders today. Stress leads to burnout so often, and that's the next one. And burnout will lead to depression. And in our session this evening, I'm going to pick up on those issues: stress, burnout, and depression, because they are the perils that we face. The area of difficulty, you can put relational before the first difficulty. Relational difficulties continue to be a massive problem. Interpersonal problems, again, plague Christian leaders. And the blank before conflict is marital conflict. That's sad to say, but it's true. Pressure of work creates pressure of relationship. Then we've got three G's, and some of you will know the three G's, and these are the very current ones. These are the ones that cause most disgrace to fall upon the name of Christ in the 1990s. And that, of course, is gold, glory, and gals. And we have seen it in our country as well as in many places of overseas, where people have been caught up with the hunger and greed of finance, and they've ripped the system off. They've skimmed the offering somehow. They've conned people. There have been those who have been full of pride and have wanted to extend their own ministry rather than the ministry of the Lord. And there's been just so many who have fallen in the area of immoral relationships. That's sad. These are some of the perils of leadership today. The gold, the glory, and the gals. When we look at the biblical qualities for leadership, and I've listed a whole range of references there, you'll be well aware of them. But these are the qualities that we're looking for which will counteract these temptations, these perils. I first of all put in the fruit of the Spirit, which should be obvious for spiritual leadership. Love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and gentleness and self-control. Nothing wrong with those. There's no law against them because they're right. We could go through the list in 1 Timothy 3, 1 through 11. And there you get the qualifications for elders. To be above reproach, the husband of but one wife. That's the key issue. Once somebody gets into infidelity, they disqualify themselves from eldership because they're no longer a one-man woman. Temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, not given to drunkenness, not violent, gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money, must manage his own family well, and a deacon likewise are to be men worthy of respect and sincere, not indulging in much wine and not pursuing dishonest gain. In 1 Timothy 6:11, the direction was given, you, man of God, flee from all this and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, endurance, and gentleness. And there it is. These are the things that should be the hallmarks of Christian leadership. And in 2 Timothy, there is the direction, chapter 2, 20 through 26, the types of people are available for service, a whole range of them. The key is to be cleansed. And then when you get down into verse 22, flee the evil desires of youth and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace, along with those who call on the name of the Lord. The same as in Titus, they're repeated. And notice as you go through all of those, the thing that is emphasized over and over and over again are character traits. Character traits, the qualities of the individual, not the giftedness, but the personal life, those real qualities that are there, that are honouring to Christ. Now this, of course, applies to Christian leadership in general, and above all, most specifically to eldership. Those qualities are a must. It doesn't say that an elder should be, it says an elder must be. No choice. And the moment an elder stops meeting those qualifications, he will automatically, of his own free will, of course, indicate to his brethren, I am struggling at this stage, I will ask to be relieved of my responsibilities until I can put my own life or my own house in order. That's what it should be. Not eldership or leadership for life, only as long as one performs. That is critical. Leadership is performance-oriented, not appointment-oriented. The integrity of the office of eldership must be upheld and maintained. The Lord has given a very high standard. But when I look at the qualifications for eldership, apart from about 3 points, all of them fall into the category of normal Christian living. They do. normal Christian living, not exceptional, normal. And with this in mind, I want to take you into an unsavoury subject, but one that must be addressed, one that we must understand, one that we must protect ourselves in and protect others from, and that is the issue of infidelity. The problem of infidelity is real today. And if you haven't recognised that, you walk around with your eyes closed and your fingers in your ears. Because if it has not happened within your fellowship, it will. And I'm not a prophet of doom, but that's what's happening and will continue to happen. Let me tell you some true stories. Only the names and the places have been changed to protect the innocent. The Reverend Alan Hope has been involved very committedly in pre-marriage counselling. A young couple, Adrian and Vivian, are to be married. And so he spends time with them. He's very caring and he gives them some very good advice. Eventually the great day of the wedding arrives and the happy couple are now united together in marriage. The Reverend Alan Hope has performed the ceremony. And so the wedding is complete and they move to the celebrations at the reception. The reception has been a very joyful occasion and at last it's over and the young couple can head off into wedded bliss. The Reverend Alan Hope joins the mother of the bride and moves off into the night. A happy ending to a lovely story. Now, what do you conclude so far from that story? What deductions can you make? Just as it is on face value. So far, so good. What was the participation of the reverend in the marriage? He did the job. He did the pre-marriage counselling, yes. Ah, he had a relative. He had a relative. One of his children was in the wedding, you see, because he goes off with the wife.
Maybe not.
Unfortunately, it was an introduction to a nightmare, not a lovely story, because he went off with the wife of another man straight after the wedding. Does it make sense? Does it make sense? It does not make sense. Here is a man claiming to be a man of God, trained in the ministry, performing roles that are so essential, helping young couples to get married, helping them to lock into a relationship that would be pure, which would enhance and entail commitment for life. And then he takes the mother of the bride and goes off into the night with her, who was somebody else's wife. Now, what does that do to the lives of that couple? What does it do to the life of the church that he belonged to? What does it say in the community in which he lived? It is sad. That is, unfortunately, not an isolated case. Let me tell you about Arthur, who was a civic leader in the community where he lived, had his own business. He was a respected elder in his church. Lynette was a very attractive, pleasant young mother, very demoted, a devoted mother, came from a very strong Christian heritage. They were really in love, very much in love, and they believed that nothing could come in between them to spoil it. It was a beautiful relationship that they enjoyed. Do you know what came in to spoil it? Well, I'll tell you. Lynette's husband and Arthur's wife and me. We upset them because they were having an affair. And yet you would believe when you heard the story that they were meant for each other. An elder of a church seducing another man's wife and then saying, "This is a wonderful relationship. We are praying God's blessing on our time together." He said, "Could you run that by me again?" We're asking God to bless our relationship. You are asking God to bless sin? Did I get you? See, they won't call it sin. Now, I could go on, and I'm not. I could go on and I could just relate horrendous story after horrendous story on these issues. No church appears to be exempt from what happens here. In a space of 2 months, I heard of 4 ministers from 3 different denominations being removed from their churches because of immorality, because of infidelity. And that was in a reasonably close radius to where I live. Unbelievable. When one of them was checked out, he was having affairs with 2 women in his church. And this was the 3rd church that had happened in. How can that be? How can a person be allowed to maintain a ministry of leadership with a record like that? If we're going to accept that, the churches are going to go down the tubes. God has set a standard, a high standard for eldership, and men, if we are unfaithful to our wives, we will automatically disqualify ourselves from holding that position. You may not hold that standard in your church, but I tell you, we do it in ours, and we make it known. The requirements for an elder is the husband of 1 wife, a 1-woman man. I am not talking about those who experience bereavement, but I'm talking about those who get involved in infidelity. You know, this is sad. We live in a Christian community, we reckon. We don't. We know better than that. It's no wonder our Muslim friends in our society claim they have the truth. And I've had them say it to me. They said, "Oh, you Christians, what you believe is rubbish. Look at us," they say. "Look at our lifestyle. We don't drink, we don't smoke, and we don't commit adultery. See, we've got a better lifestyle than you. We have higher standards of morality than you do. And you try and say you've got the truth? Come back and tell me another story." End of the argument from them. It's true. And people see these things. Christians living a lie. That's what happens. How sad for them. How sad for any believer to be struggling knowingly that they are doing what is wrong. Sad for them and sad for the Christian community, but how sad for the Lord. What does it do to the Lord himself? His honour is brought into disrepute because of his people. And I say this, if this sort of behaviour is happening in leadership, what in the world is happening in the ranks? If the leaders are behaving like this, if those who are supposed to be men who walk with God are doing things like that, what's happening to the average believer? I would hate to think, I would hope, that they're more committed than those leaders. I would say this to you today, that if you are a leader, or you want to be a leader, you will need to be equipped not to fall in that way, and you will need to be able to equip others and help others to avoid that, or if you find others have failed, to be able to help them out. We live in a time when we do have changing community standards. We've seen that. We've seen changes in behaviour, but we also see changes in the acceptable practices that go on in our communities. These changes of standards and of morality eventually influence the Christian community. We call it situation ethics. You find it happening in the Old Testament. That which was acceptable in the community but not amongst God's people gradually was absorbed. And it's usually that the Christian community is about 3 or 4 years behind the standards of the community in which they live. That seems to be shortening these days, which is a real problem. But you see, that which was called immorality or adultery now has an air of respectability. You watch your soapies if you ever want to waste time. I don't actually get into that, but I believe that's what they're all about. What is a normal family on a TV program? Do they have a normal family? that we would know. Hardly a normal family. You see, immorality, adultery now is called an affair. Or it's called an encounter. It's sometimes called an extramarital relationship. Sometimes it's called a romantic interlude. I suggest to you, men, that sin by any other name is still sin. Don't fall into the trap when you're talking to people and they talk about affairs. Oh, somebody had an affair. You mean to say they committed adultery? Name it. Oh, that's sin, isn't it? Name it. They don't like to hear it. They will seek to justify themselves. Just because it is common within our community is no excuse for Christians to be involved. Do you realise that Christian standards were set and practiced in an immoral world? You go back to the New Testament days and have a look at the level of morality then. Look at the level of immorality, and it was staggering. What was it that made Christians stand out in their day? It was their virtue. It was the purity of life. They were outstanding people. They did not follow the practices of the heathen, those who did not know God. But what happens in our day and age? Can you discern the difference? Can you? Hopefully you can, but often you can't. I want to say to you, and we're down to point two in our outline here, that infidelity is not innocent. Infidelity is not an accident. Now, I know people say that it is, but if you were to use your imagination, just check the question out. See, I dropped the pen. That's an accident. Okay. Yes, I've been involved in an affair. It was just an accident. An accident? Now, you are wise enough to realise what happens in a sexual encounter. An accident? I tripped over? Accident? And I've... You've got to be kidding! These things don't just happen like that, and yet people would say, it was an accident. Who are they talking to? And there are enough gullible people around to say, fancy that. I tell you what, it's not an instant idea that takes place. I want to tell you it is premeditated. I want to tell you that there is preparation for infidelity. Some of it is most deliberate indeed, calculated and worked on. For some it's subconscious, but it's been thought about. Sometimes it's long-term thinking, other times it's short-term thinking, but never an accident. Never an accident, because it takes choice. I'll go for that water in a minute. It takes choice, and it takes action, it takes things to be done. It was like a man that I was counselling who was on drugs, and he would get them in Melbourne, and he decided that he was off them. Anyway, next time he came to see me, I said, how's it going? He said, he said, I got my drugs again. He said, it was a real pain. He said, I couldn't help it. It was an accident. And I said, tell me, where did you get them? He said, in Melbourne. I said, it was an accident. You actually got in your car accidentally, and you accidentally put your foot, on the accelerator and accidentally steered it all the way to Melbourne. That's amazing. It wasn't an accident at all. He wanted it, and he went after it. And people will do things like that. Let's have a look at the story of David and Bathsheba. You know the story well. It's 2 Samuel chapter 11. You might like to turn to it. David, King David, is walking on the perimeter of his palace walls. Maybe it was a night like this, you'd appreciate it, wouldn't you? Looking for a breeze. I don't know if it was as humid over there. It usually isn't. But there he is. He hadn't really sat down long term to plan to have this affair, because he was walking around. And he sees a very beautiful woman bathing. And his attention is caught. I want to suggest to you that he had not sat down to deliberately plan that long term. But he's now involved in short term planning. David, did he have sexual problems? Was he sexually unfulfilled as a man? Were these great sexual drives that he had overpowering him? And there are men who would say, I can't control myself. You've got to be kidding. You've got to be kidding. Sure, some may struggle, but if somebody's out of control, watch out. David had at this time more than seven wives. He also had several concubines. Up to this point, he had fathered 17 children, and he was approximately 39 years of age. And it was in this state that he spots this beautiful woman who is naked bathing. What was his problem? What about Bathsheba? We don't know a great deal about her. Let's assume that she was a faithful wife. Her husband is away on military duty. We have to ask the question, what were their, and I say there for both of them, what were their unmet needs that they were experiencing at that stage? What was causing David to walk around the wall of the palace? Was he, as some people suggest, up there walking around wondering about what in the world was going on with the battle? I think it most unlikely. If he was worried about the battle, he would have been up front like the kings used to be. But he was back home. I want to suggest, and it's only an educated guess, and don't ask me for chapter and verse, but I want to suggest to you that he possibly had some personality problems going on, some interpersonal relational conflicts going on. There is nothing like a conflict between a husband and wife to upset a person. And he had seven of them at least to have conflict with. And maybe that night as David selected which wife he was going to take to bed with him, that she might have said, sorry, I've got a headache. She might have had a conflict, might have argued with him. She might have put him down. And so he's upset and he gets out there and he's walking around and he's muttering and mumbling to himself and he looks and he has a need in his life at that point in time. And there's a wrong thought and he's gone. Men, watch this. If you are in conflict with your partner, you are at a point of vulnerability. You had better believe that. I can write a scenario of everyone I have ever dealt with who has fallen into adultery. And that's where it so often begins. Conflict between their partners. Just conflict. Enough to put them offside and off balance. Well, we know what happens. David looked. Is looking sin? Of course not. You can appreciate beauty, and there's a whole range of way of presenting beauty. He would have known what the fifth and the tenth commandments were, but he looked, but the trouble was, he continued to look. I can remember Billy Graham saying once, if you look at something and you realise that it's not right, that is not sin. It's when you go back for the second look. Okay, we can see things that aren't right and we may not be looking for them, and that happens very frequently today, but it's if you go back for the second look, then you sinned because you know what you're looking at. And we as men have to watch that, because there is exposure to things that are not helpful to us on every hand. Turn your television on. How much can you watch? How much can you watch that's going to be helpful to you? How much can you watch that's going to feed the old sin nature? What about the videos that are used? Very few videos can be used in a way that's going to be beneficial to believers, unless you get good videos. the ones that have got good messages, something in them. But from an entertainment value, very few. What sort of magazines? What do you see in the news agents? Even covers are bad enough. I know people who, when they go into news agents, they'll go right around away from magazines where they are. They say, we want nothing to do with them. Is that prudish? Is it being out of touch? Or is it that they want to protect themselves? And they're looking to protect themselves. Well, David looked. Did he compare these wives of David had already borne him children? I am staggered when I listen to some men put pressure onto their wives to maintain the figure of their youth when they've borne them children. They put pressure on their wives to diet, to exercise, because they want them to have a shapely body. You want to have a look at your own. And if your wife has borne you children, you're to blame, because her body has gone through tremendous stress. Okay, there are things that people can do to help themselves, I know that. But for a husband to put pressure on his wife is not demonstrating love. Encouragement you can, but to coerce them, no. Well, he looked and he liked what he looked. And he lingered. Cop this for alliteration, folks. A lot of L's. Okay, he looked and he lingered. Imagination took over, and that was the problem. He looked and he started to fantasize, and that's what a lot of people do. And fantasy flowers. And then he developed a strategy. Boy, he said, I would like that woman. And as I say, he knew the commandments. And within his heart, he lusted. He wanted her. And he committed adultery. We know that. And following that, notice what else happens. It happens all the time. He lied. Lying goes with infidelity. It goes hand in hand. He schemed. And that goes hand in hand with it. And he deceived. And that goes hand in hand with it. And he went a step further. And he engineered murder. What a tragedy. And it all started maybe because there was a disagreement. But he was out and he looked. And he lingered. And he fantasized. And he was gone. He also lost in this whole encounter. He lost his honour. He could never recapture that. Remember that. We often speak to young people on this issue. I've said for years to young people, save yourself for the right partner. You'll be so glad you did. Once you lose it, you can never regain it. He lost his honour. His people knew of his failure. You can't hide a thing like that. He lost the son that was conceived. What a tragedy. I know he experienced God's grace. I know that sin can be forgiven, but the consequences of sin can last for a lifetime. And even though somebody may be forgiven and enjoy forgiveness, there are consequences that will impact a person, and sometimes they do last for a lifetime. Slip over to Genesis 39. That's a story you know well, told so often in Sunday schools, the story of Joseph in Potiphar's household. Joseph, a strong young man, a very handsome young man, would have been very attractive to women. Wonder what the problem was there. Fascinating, really, when you just check it out a little bit. One thing that I identified with Joseph throughout his life, he wanted to honour God. He really did. Did he know the text that said, if you honour me, I will honour you? But you check it out. He continually wanted to honour God in what he did. Here he is in this household of Potiphar, an official of Pharaoh, living in the palace area. Did you know that those officials who served Pharaoh would have been neutered? Or would have been neutered? That was standard procedure if you're going to have that position. I wonder what Potiphar's wife's problem was. See? Total frustration in sexual relationship. And here is this young, virile, handsome young man. And she spots him and she seeks to seduce him. And we have to realize that this takes place. Both male and female from time to time will seek to seduce people. And it happens within the framework of the Christian church. So here is Joseph being seduced. Very strongly, he submits himself to the will of God and God's way. That was his area of submission. And so we know that he shuns that seduction and says, sorry, I'm not in that. I want to honour God. I want to honour my master. The woman, of course, was angry, extremely angry, because she had been shunned and rebuked. There was a second seduction, much stronger this time. And once again, he seeks to shun the approach. There is a struggle and she becomes much more animated in her seduction. And so as he struggles, he leaves behind his coat and goes. He's shot through. Okay? He wasn't going to stand around. And this is one of the big issues when it comes to areas of temptation. You don't stay around there. If there is an area where you're going to be tempted and even seduced, you go. Sorry, I'm out of here. Circumstances don't make the man, they reveal him. And what did Joseph reveal of himself in that situation? A young man who wanted to honour God, irrespective of the temptation that was placed in his way. Do you think she could have been a beautiful person? Attractive? Usually they were in those situations. Do you think he had any problems himself? He would have been probably at the peak of his sexual drives at that time. But he was prepared to say, no way. You see, we're like tea bags. Our real strength comes out when we get into hot water. Okay? And that's exactly what happened there to Joseph. Let me equip you with what I've called here some pre-infidelity indicators. When is a person likely to fall into infidelity? It comes down there on page 10 under point 3A. Unmet needs would be one of the real causes. Unmet needs. Do you have any unmet needs in your life? I just wanted somebody who would care for me. Commonly phrased and repeated. You see, in my relationship with my partner, they really didn't care for me. I just wanted somebody who would care for me. Do you care for your partner? Do you feel cared for? I just wanted somebody who needed me. I don't feel needed. I'm just there. I'm just an appendage. I just work around the house. I just go out and work to bring money in. I'm not needed. I just wanted somebody to appreciate me. That's all I want. I just wanted somebody who would listen to me. Somebody who'd hear what I had to say. I just wanted somebody who would understand me. That's all I was looking for. I wanted somebody who would respect me. And as I list these things to you, this is not a total list of one person's need. One of those needs is enough to get somebody out of kilter. Oh, I'm just wanting somebody who thinks I'm attractive. I just want somebody who thinks I've got something to offer. This is how people think. I want somebody who finds me exciting. That's what I want. I want somebody who finds me intellectually stimulating. I want somebody who would romance me. That's why it happened. This person was just so understanding, so gentle, so tender, said some very nice things. Hasn't happened to me for years and I just couldn't help it. It was an accident. That's how they say. There is a deep need for every individual to know love. If our basic emotional needs are not being met, we'll be in trouble. We all need to know acceptance. We need to know that we belong. We need to know that we're cared for. We need to experience tenderness. And if we don't, we'll not function at the level we should. The issue of unresolved conflicts. If our conflicts with our partners are left unresolved, we will get into difficulty. Let me tell you a story, simple scenario, but this is not uncommon. Husband and wife working around early in the morning getting ready for the day, and in their interaction there is conflict. Some harsh words are said, something is misunderstood. And the husband says, well, I'm going anyway. And he's off, slams the door, and he's off on his way to work. And his wife standing back saying, he didn't even say goodbye. He didn't even kiss me goodbye, as a matter of fact. And she is really upset. Churn, churn, churn. He's out in the car and leaves wheelies as he goes, you know. And he's angry too, and he takes it out on all of the other motorists till he gets to work, and he takes it out on the guys at work for a while. Then he settles down into his work pattern and becomes absorbed. And he's like that, no, he's okay, until he pulls up into the drive at night, and just as he opens the car door, it triggers a little memory stop in the mind. They say, oh, we were in conflict this morning. And so when he opens the door and comes in, and there's the greeting. Still not talking. Tea is ready. On the table. Okay. And so they sit down to have a delightful meal. Pepper. Salt. That was about the conversation. And then to enhance the relationship, they spend a very exciting communicating evening in front of the box. What's on? I don't know. And then it's time to go to bed. And as they move up into the bedroom and start getting ready, all of a sudden the husband happens to look out of the corner of his eye and he sees his wife in a state of half undress, and he becomes interested because he's turned on by sight, sexually stimulated by what he sees. And then they hop into bed and accidentally touch, and he's further stimulated sexually because he's stimulated by touch. And then he makes a sexual advance toward his wife, and she says, you get away from me, you animal. You see? And he says, what's wrong with you? You're frigid, you know. And it's on. Now, neither have understood the dynamics. Now, if that is let go, both of them are in dire straits, and they could move down the pathway of infidelity. Simple as that. Now, let's just check out a couple of things there. There are many men who do not know how to love. That's why they finish up trying to get all of the bizarre, perverted means of love making, and they'll even go into the sex shops and see what they can get there to enhance their love making. The biggest trap is they have never yet learned how to love. They don't know that the wife needs to be loved in the soul, first of all, before she'll respond sexually. They're not aware of that. And they've got this big macho image, and they have no idea how to be a mature lover. They're narcissistic lovers. That means they are interested in themselves and what they're going to get. He's got to know that his wife is hurting, and she is still upset, and she feels that she's not wanted, not appreciated. And all that guy has to say when he came home, or he should have, when he was at work, got on the phone and said, honey, I am so sorry that I walked out like that. We're not even talking about what the conflict was over. His action was wrong. Honey, I'm sorry. Will you forgive me? And he would come home, perhaps carrying a bunch of flowers, box of chocolates, I don't know what. And when she comes to the door, she says, I had a fight this morning, and the kids have been fighting all day, and I burnt the tea, and now you've come home drunk. So if it's not a common practice, you've got to be careful with some reactions there. But you make some effort, some tangible efforts. Honey, I am sorry for my behaviour. I just love you so much, and I was out of order. Now, if he had done that, then there's a reconciliation underway. He's making the right moves. He can't be responsible for how she reacts. But of course, you see, his wife didn't understand also the sex drives that the man has. and she's grumbling at him because she doesn't understand him. And you've got two people who do not understand each other, and you've got a great recipe for conflict. We've got to recognize that it's the thoughtfulness, the tenderness, the care that creates a love relationship. Love-making sexual relationships do not begin and end in the bedroom. That's the greatest disaster in the world. It's your loving relationship throughout the day and the previous day and the previous day that's going to contribute to the fulfillment of a sexual relationship, because the fulfilled sexual relationship comes out of a love relationship, a soul relationship, and the sexual relationship is a response relationship. And we've got it all out of kilter, a lot of people. And when these needs are unmet and when there's a little bit of conflict, the guy gets to work. Mutter, mutter, he says. Nagging wife, growling at me like that. And he's chewing over what's going on. And as he's at work, he's talking, and one of the female employees comes along and says, "Hi, Fred, how are you?" "Oh, I don't like to see you upset." He said, "Boy, she's an understanding person. Wish my wife was a bit more understanding like that." What's happened? The seeds of infidelity have been planted. Let me just share with you a little chart that helps set the scene. When we are in a married relationship, I think it's as James Dobson calls it, it's a good one, we live a straight life. Committed to one partner for life. Amen to that? Best way to go for that. Now, somebody in this situation is walking along the straight life, and now there has been that bit of a conflict and they feel a little bit off that. And as they walk that way, there is the first simple little contact. "How are you today?" "I'm not so good." "Well, that's a pity. You're a nice person. Why should you feel like that?" Interest. There's the first little thought. Okay, he continues just to function along. Next time the same person comes in, "Oh, look, I've just brought these papers for you." Places them down on the desk, and there's an accidental touch. It might be just of the arms. And that was all. Accidental. They talk more. And he thinks, "Boy, what an understanding person. Not like that at home. All I do when I get home is grumble, grumble, fight, fight. Not understood, not cared." And so more innocent time is spent, and they sit down for morning tea, reach across to get a spoon, and there's a touch, but it lingers a bit longer, and there's a slight moving away again, bit by bit, and then there's more time, and more time further away, and then next thing, they're in to an affair. Accidental, little by little. And I tell you what happens here. It's as the couple, the people involved, start sharing emotions. They've got somebody who's going to listen to them. And so they start talking about the real deep needs that they have within themselves. They share emotionally. Every husband and wife should be sharing emotionally with each other. And as you share emotionally and understand and support each other, there is so often that physical response, "Honey, let me hold you." See? And people will engage, and they're off into a sexual relationship. Would you believe it happens as simply as that? Because I tell you it does. Starts as simply as that, where there's a bit of conflict between a husband and wife, they meet somebody who is not quite as happy either, and there can be often two married partners involved, and off they go. It can be one married partner meeting a single person, and they interact, just talk, talk, talk. Somebody understands, somebody cares. Next thing, they're into a relationship. And it blows them away. How could we get involved in that? But they do. And I tell you this, as I mentioned before, that once a person is involved like that, they change. And I'll pick some of those things up in just a couple of minutes. Watch it carefully. Often a person who is emotionally immature can fall into that. They become very self-centered in their own lives. They look for self-gratification always, and they really want to demonstrate that they are still sexually attractive to the opposite sex, and they'll try and move away into a relationship with a younger person. That is a problem. Some people are looking for love and they don't know how to find it. I was counselling a guy who was a sexual deviant a few years ago. And one day he was telling me that he had visited a prostitute. And he said he nearly murdered her. He was tempted to murder her afterwards. And I said, tell me what went on. What was it all about? He really was saying this, I was looking for love. And he said, all I got was sex. And he said, I was angry. She let me down. You see, he was looking for love and all he got was sex. Don't equate them. I say, in a marriage relationship, sex is a response to love. You've got that? It's a response to love. There's got to be that deep love in relationship first. And we live in a world that is all mixed up. And that's why there's not a happiness there. And Christians are falling for it. I get so disturbed when I hear Christian couples sharing with one another their own sexual lives. I say to you, a husband and wife have got a unique relationship. You should never ever share your intimate details of your marriage with anybody. It's between you and your partner, and nobody else will experience what you experience because you're different. It goes back to what I've been saying earlier. We need to keep it so intimate and not share like that. And if you do, you get into trouble. People are looking for something else, saying, I haven't got that, and they've never learned yet to love. Let me share with you some infidelity behaviours, the sorts of things that can demonstrate that a person is involved in infidelity. The first thing is the person becomes a very deceptive person, and dishonesty becomes par for the course. Somebody who used to be so honest, patently honest, will lie. Will lie to your face and smile as they do it. You want to hear the stories that I have been told by people who are involved in infidelity. Blatant lies. They lie to everybody to cover themselves. And I would suggest this to you. Once you move off the straight path and start to involve yourself into something that is wrong, every other area of your life will start to be perverted too. It will start to break down. Deceit is there. Duplicity is there. But people live a lie and they have no difficulty in telling lies. It is sad. Their integrity goes. And truth becomes expendable. No, no, I'm not involved in that. No, never. And they get caught. When you counsel with them, you'd love to believe what they're saying, but you can't believe them. It's actions that count in these situations. I can remember confronting a man once, and I said to him, you must never go to that house again. You must never do that, because the husband was away and he'd been having an affair with a neighbour. You just must never go there. Okay, I will not do it again. Okay, I've got the husband of the wife who had been caught in this adultery in my office. This is some weeks later, and he's saying, man, he said, I don't know what it's all about. He said, I'm trying to do my best, but he said, we're not getting anywhere. He said, I just feel I'm a failure. I said, look, I'll ring your wife and just see. She'll tell us what's going on. And I rang the wife and said, hey, you know, I've got your husband here and he's really struggling. He just feels he's not really getting through. He's not clear. She said, oh, it's not his fault. She said, the other guy keeps coming across. I'll never go there again. And he was continuing to push the affair. She wanted out of it, but he was pushing, you see. Lying through his teeth, they were false. But okay, it's a serious thing though, man. It really is serious, and that was the score. And I just said to this young husband, three children, I said, look, it's not you, it's the other guy. He's still coming across. He just stood up from where he was sitting and he said, I'll kill him. Up until that point he had been strong, he'd been hurt, but he just said, yeah, he said, I will kill him. And if I had to let him go at that point, I believe he would have done it. Okay. Oh, he was so angry. And he didn't sin. He was angry at sin. The other thing that you will notice is a partner will become very passive in the relationship. A person who is involved in infidelity begins to back off on their normal relationship. Why would that be? Because they're experiencing expending their energies and their emotion to the illicit relationship, it's got that sense of intrigue in it, you see. It becomes exciting. That's how they read it, because it's wrong. And they're sneaking out to do it. And it just adds an air of excitement. I say to folk, look, in your marriage relationship, maintain excitement in it. Don't let the excitement go out of your relationship. Be special, make it special. But you see, folks sit back and we're happy in it. But the partner's got needs that aren't being met. Not excuses, but this is what happens. You find that in a situation where somebody's involved in infidelity, they begin to compare and they begin to put down their partner. It causes discontent and discouragement, and there is a greater distancing in the normal relationship. You'll find the person who's involved in infidelity building up with their own thinking a secret death wish. Particularly this is amongst Christians. They just think, oh, if my partner would just die in their sleep, it would make it so much easier. I would be then free to continue this relationship. Does that disturb you? But that's how people do think. I've had them tell me that. If I would just die, then I would be free. There would be no disgrace, nothing to hide. People fail in the area of infidelity. And as I talk to you today on the law of averages, there could be possibly some of you here who have already failed in that area. That would be sad, wouldn't it? But I'm a realist. And you've got to recognise that within your churches there will be those who will have failed. And they will have hurt very deeply. Those who continue on need to be found out and they need to be disciplined. But once we come across it within our churches, we must realise that the full spectrum of emotion and trauma will be experienced by those people. It's a devastating time. It all starts to come out. And those who handle it need to be very, very careful how they do. I would say to you that in the situation of infidelity, you'll normally find there is a guilty and an innocent party. Okay? I'll qualify that. Two people contribute to a marriage. But you can have one person who will go off and commit sexual immorality and the other person will not. The person who has gone out and committed sexual immorality is guilty. The one who is not guilty of that. Do you hear what I'm saying? There is a guilty and innocent party in this issue. Both people contribute to the conflict in the marriage. But the person who has gone out and committed adultery is responsible himself or herself and can't say, they made me do it. They didn't make them do it. The situation wasn't good, but they chose to do it. And we've got to realise that people will blame others for their actions. We must own our own actions. We must own our own thoughts. We must own our own words. We must be responsible people. Do not blame others for what you say, think, do, or respond to. You are responsible. But so often they want to blame somebody else. So there is a guilty and there is an innocent party. Let's talk about the innocent one, the one whose partner has gone off and committed adultery. Emotionally, they can be mortally wounded, really. I have spoken to some ladies whose husbands have committed adultery and they have felt so betrayed. I never thought that would ever happen in my marriage. Totally betrayed, wounded. And you know, the sad thing is that so often it is the one who is innocent, they're the ones who have to do the work to try and cause the reconciliation. Often the one who's off in the affair is saying, I just want to keep the affair going. And the one who has been wounded is trying to cause a reconciliation in the marriage. Often they are ready to forgive and to seek forgiveness in it. That's often the case. They're the ones who will make a lot of moves. On the other hand, you may find some will react in the opposite way and become so angry and so bitter and say, this is it, never again, I will never forgive in this situation. There seems to be the two extremes for the one who has been innocent. When you deal with the one who is guilty, you will find that some will be extremely remorseful and they will acknowledge it was stupid, it was wrong, it was sinful. They will readily seek forgiveness and reconciliation. And there's sometimes a big question mark as to how sincere they are. How will you know if they are sincere? by what they say? Not likely. Because what they say is meaningless. It's by how they begin to live. People say, will I ever be able to trust my partner again? Good question. Will they? Not initially. Not initially. If you were driving along, as you probably normally do, and you see a green light and you go through it, you do that day after day, and one day you're going through a green light and all of a sudden, wham! Somebody smashes into your side and they've gone and driven through a red light. Okay? That's a shock experience. The next time you get in a car and you drive up to a green light, what are you going to do? And go across. Where is your trust in those lights? Experience has showed you that you can't always trust them. And it's only after a period of time that you keep going through them and finding out, hey, that's okay, that's okay. And it's only over a period of time that trust in a relationship can be restored. Those who have been the offender expect it to be restored immediately, and it won't happen. I would say to guys and to women who've been involved, you have to be prepared that your partner will not trust you. It's going to take quite a while for them to regain your trust, and you're the one who's going to have to prove it to them. And that's fair enough. It really is fair enough. And they will feel upset about it because they don't trust me. They think, oh, you've caused the scene, you've got to wear that. Now, on the other hand, the guilty party may be extremely unrepentant and very blasé in what they do. They can even be very uncooperative as you try and bring it together. They may seek to continue the illicit relationship even though they're saying, no, we're out of it. And they'll be very underhand. And if that relationship has stopped, they'll often go off and try and start another one. And so that can happen too as you seek to bring them back together. If you are involved in trying to work in a situation where there has been infidelity, you're going to have to be very wise and sensitive. You are going to have to be non-judgmental as you deal with them. Caring, careful counselling is required. How can you be non-judgmental in a situation like that? What does Galatians 6:1 say? Somebody want to tell me? What does it say? Keep it coming. Keep it coming. Yes. Keep it coming. Considering yourself. Yes, in case you fall. Okay, we're going to handle the work and we're going to help you here. I'm not here to condemn you. That's not my job. I'm not here as a judge. I am here to help you work this through. The Word of God will judge you. God will judge you. But that's not my position. If somebody's unrepentant, the church may have to move in and deal with. That's another issue. But let's see, how do we handle them? Be biblical. Be biblical. Handle the truth in love. Do you know Scripture says mercy triumphs over judgment? It really does. That's out of James. Beautiful passage, James 2:13, 3:13, in that bracket there. Mercy triumphs over judgment. Boy, we're going to make an example of these people. We're going to sort them out. Look, if somebody has sinned, and if they have repented and they put it right, what do? You certainly rejoice. But there are people who say, we will make an example of you, and they will act quite unbiblically with it. Mercy triumphs over judgment. The classic illustration is when Christ is confronted with that woman taken in adultery. And you know the hypocrisy in that, don't you? Why didn't those men bring the man who was involved? Why did they only bring a woman? See, two takes two, doesn't it? And yet they only brought the woman. Okay? The law said she should be stoned. If she was stoned, executed, it was according to the law, it would have been right. Said to Jesus, okay, what do you say? And his response, brilliant, wasn't it? Whoever is without sin may cast the first stone. In other words, are you sinless? You've never failed? You want? And of course, they all walk away. She is left with the Lord, the only one who could throw the stone. He just said, the first stone. Everyone else could have tossed in after that, okay? He was the one. He was the one who could have thrown the first stone. Where are your accusers? They've gone. Well, I don't accuse you either. Go and sin no more. he would have been perfectly within the bounds of the law to have executed her. What happened? Mercy triumphed over judgment. Which was the higher law? The law that said death, or the law which said forgiven and free? Which is the better law? Which is the higher law? Which is the law that we enjoy and rejoice in? And we need to deal with people like that. Seek them to be won back. And these people who fall will so often have reasons within them. There'll be unmet needs. It's not an excuse. It's understanding. As we work with them and seek to bring them back, repentance is essential and evidence must be seen. There needs to be forgiveness sought and forgiveness shared from the person who is being restored with the partner and with the Lord. It's two-way there. There must be restoration of the relationship. It takes time. You've got to bring them back. You've got to see reconciliation. And again, that must be worked on. Time doesn't allow us to go into a lot of detail on that. But I want to say to you that we need to be prepared for temptation. And if we have a look at it just briefly, it's some anti-infidelity information there. Prepare for temptation. Where does temptation begin? I want to suggest it begins in the mind. Do you realize what the most important sex organ is? The mind. The mind. And that's where it will start. As a man thinks, so he is. Look at Matthew 5, 27, 28. The Lord said, "You have heard it was said, do not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Now the word "looks" is in a present tense and it means a continual habit of life. This is what this practice of the person is. And to look lustfully, it means he's lustfully, he's committing adultery with the person in his mind. He's picturing it. He's going through it. If you are lustfully looking, you've already committed adultery in your heart. If you look at a woman like that, and the Lord said, that is not on. We've got to watch that we do not allow ourselves to fantasize, because fantasy will take over. If you start thinking it's wrong and you develop the relationship is wrong, and then you get hold of another picture and I'd be better off with somebody else, then you're in trouble, because fantasy touches the emotion, creates emotion, and then emotion screams out for the actual experience. People who start watching blue movies, they start to see all the erotic things that happen, and next thing they're fantasizing with it, and off they go. You just avoid all that like the plague. So what happens when one seems to be emotionally committed to an affair? It's the emotions that rule, and that's why logic and truth and reason go out the window. You see, this is what some people have said, and I've heard them say it. They talk about an illicit relationship and they say anything this good must be right. Anything that feels this good must be of God. That's their excuse given. The feeling is so wonderful. I've asked God to take it away if it's wrong. And he hasn't, so it must be right. Does that sound reasonable? Because that's what they will say. We have prayed about it together to ask God to show us if we are wrong. But he hasn't. But he hasn't. It's okay. That's what they say. One minister, when he was challenged about an illicit affair, he said, "I would rather go to hell with this woman than to heaven with my wife." And you say, good grief. But you see, that's unreasonable, it's illogical, it's irrational. Anyone in their sane senses wouldn't say something like that. But that's what people will say and do. It's a problem. That is the fantasy that sort of goes with it. Watch it. James 1, 13 to 15 talks about temptation. When temptation comes your way, do not blame God for it. Who is the person who is desiring it? The one who has the temptation. There's a desire of heart. You don't even allow it to develop there. What we need to do is to have the mind of Christ in us. Develop a biblical conscience. Know what God wants for us. Lord, I want a conscience that is sharpened by your word. I want a conscience that is motivated and moved by the Holy Spirit. I want to be obedient to the direction of the Father. I need the Holy Spirit to fill my life. I need to live in and live by your word so that I live it right. Don't you think that you can't fall? Don't you think that? Because men have fallen over the years and they would say they'd never do it. We must commit ourselves to the Lord on a daily basis and commit ourselves to our partners and commit ourselves to resolve any issue that would come up. Don't fear temptation. Resist it. That's what the Bible says. You don't fear temptation. You resist it. If temptation is there, go away from it. The scripture says in 1 Peter 1:13, prepare your mind for action. Make sure that if you're ever tempted, you know what the plan of attack is. I'm ready for a battle, and if that ever happens to me, I am gone. I'm going to be like Joseph. I'm out of the place. I will choose to be faithful. My commitment is to be faithful to my partner. I will say it over and over again. My commitment is to be faithful to my partner and nothing else. You've got to prepare your mind for action. Don't you entertain the idea, maybe somebody else might be a bit better. You don't even entertain that thought. You commit yourself to your partner. Philippians 4:8 tells us what to think on, whatever things are true and honest and just and pure and lovely and of good report. If there's any virtue, if there's any praise, you think on those. That is the test pattern for your thoughts, and you give no thought to anything that's outside of that. We must be disciplined. The enemy wants you to fall, and if there is one way he will get men to fall, it is in the area of infidelity. I've had people say to me, I've had men say to me, I would never be unfaithful to my partner. No way, never would I be unfaithful to my wife. And I've even heard women say, well, I'll never be unfaithful to my husband. That's tremendous. My answer to that is, that's all right for you, but what about them? What about them? You're saying, I'll never be unfaithful to them. But I say, what about them? Are you meeting their needs? Are you taking them for granted? Do you treat your relationship casually? You might be happy with that, but your partner may not. And there might be crying needs. I've heard so many women say, my husband doesn't care. He works, he comes home, and he goes, and he comes home. I'm a nothing. And then somebody just says, that is so sad. A person like you, you are such a special person. How could your husband think of you like that? I can't understand it. You're such a lovely person. What's going on in the mind of the wife? Wow. What a lovely person. Somebody to understand like that. And off they go. Oh, you may never do it. You may never be unfaithful. But are you making sure that you're meeting the needs of your partner? See the challenge? It's a two-way issue, folks. Heavy things, they're real. I hope that you never have to face it. But on the law of averages, you will be dealing with people who face it. But the first thing is, you make sure that your life is right. That's the key. And then you're in a position to help others to avoid that rather than go through it. Let's learn to develop a maintenance teaching within our churches, a preventative teaching in our churches that hinders people falling in this way. Perils of leadership, and that is one of them. Infidelity, a real peril.